Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
I actually think the system we have now is really what's irresponsible. When you look at a state or local government that is trying to invest in its infrastructure, you know, basic capital investment, maybe it's a water treatment facility or a sewage treatment plant, that government entity is going to pay at least twice over when you add in all the interest costs that it will have to spend in servicing its bonds, basically, when it borrows money to make a capital investment. Whereas if the Federal Reserve were to advance the money directly at zero interest, obviously that state or local government is only paying for that investment one time over. And if the money is actually issued directly by the federal government, it could be no cost at all to taxpayers. And in fact, it would probably reduce government deficits because it would be putting taxpaying resources back to work.
That's our guest this week, Dr. Timothy Canova. Hello once again, and welcome back to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree. You've heard us talk about many aspects of systemic deficiencies in our current monetary regime and how having a big central bank to make everything flow is critical. Well, we won't belabor it, but Greece, Puerto Rico, and Detroit are all recent examples of what happens when you don't have a sovereign central source of credit. Things and people stop working. Our guest, Dr. Timothy Canova, one of the nation's experts on our central bank, the Federal Reserve, knows a thing or two about this. His opening comment gives you a sense of how the Fed's disconnection from Main Street presents a formidable barrier to economic progress for the people. His conversation with Ellen is coming right up. After we hear from Tim, Ellen and I will be discussing why Donald Trump may have one unusual characteristic that could make him a useful chief executive. And again, it has to do with how things are managed at the central bank level. Matt Stannard will be along with a visionary process for our Fed. And then we turn to where the action is really happening on the ground, local economies, as we talk with Gwen Hall-Smith about her new book with Michael Schumann called Vermont Dollars, Vermont Cents, which is a handbook model for getting the magic of local investing and community collaboration up and running in America. So let's get started with Ellen Brown.
It's my honor and pleasure to be speaking with Professor Timothy Canova, who is one of the most knowledgeable people on the planet on the legal underpinnings and legal history of the Federal Reserve. Tim is currently professor of law and public finance at Nova Southeastern University in Florida. He has also taught at a number of other universities, practiced law at Gibson, Dun & Crutcher in New York City, served as legislative assistant to the late Senator Paul Tsongas, and served on an advisory committee put together by Senator Bernie Sanders on reforming the Fed. It's great to talk to you, Tim.
Thanks, Ellen. Nice to be here with you.
So you wrote a really informative article titled Who Runs the Fed that was recently published in Dissent magazine. I have a lot of questions on that. I think you can answer. You have the answer to our questions on quantitative easing, how it works. But to start out with, who does run the Fed? Is it really the independent, socially neutral public agency that we've been told, or is somebody pulling the strings behind it?
Well, people are pulling the strings. It may be independent of the political branches of government in many ways, but it's not independent of private industry, by which I mean Wall Street interests, large banks, and the bureaucracy around those large banks. I think the Fed has been, a long time ago, been co-opted by Wall Street. So its policies often reflect what Wall Street wants, and there's no public accountability in the decision-making process. As far as the way the Federal Reserve has been helping Wall Street interests, and how that has changed over the years, where its authority comes from, the Fed has two main ways that it is able to intervene in the economy. The first is under Section 13 of the Federal Reserve Act, which gives the Federal Reserve its lender of last resort powers, essentially its powers to lend money at virtually any interest rate it wants to private financial interests. For that matter, it used to have the authority to make loans directly to Main Street interests, to corporations and partnerships engaged in non-banking activities such as manufacturing businesses. Since the financial crisis, the Fed has made trillions of dollars of loans to Wall Street. The Government Accountability Office had an audit. This was an audit that was mandated under the Dodd-Frank Act. And actually, these audit provisions had been put into the Dodd-Frank Act by Senator Bernie Sanders at the time. And this GAO audit showed that the Fed has made more than, or did make during the financial crisis, more than $16 trillion of very low interest rate loans to big Wall Street banks and hedge funds and foreign banks and foreign central banks. Back in the 1930s and 1940s, the Fed used these lender of last resort powers, as I was saying, to make loans directly to Main Street businesses to help them get back on their feet during the Great Depression. And when any of us would try to urge the Fed to use these same powers to make loans directly to Main Street interests in the last few years, we were met with the conclusion by Fed officials that they lacked the legal authority to do this, which is really quite an overstatement. Even the Dodd-Frank Act, which has imposed some limitations on the Fed's powers, still allows the Fed to make these loans directly to Main Street interests as long as they're part of a broad-based program of eligibility and that it has the approval of five of the seven Federal Reserve Board governors and the Treasury Secretary. So there still is some statutory authority where the Fed could use its lender of last resort powers to lend directly to Main Street. The other way the Fed has...
How would you define a broad-based authority? In other words, you're saying they could lend to all car companies, for example?
That would be one example. Government. Absolutely. That's broad-based eligibility. The reason this was put into the Dodd-Frank Act was to prevent the Fed from picking specific winners in the marketplace, like the American Insurance Group, AIG, or helping J.P. Morgan, helping J.P. Morgan purchase Bear Stearns, for instance. Mm-hmm. Those would not have been broad-based programs of eligibility. They were really directed to helping one particular company at a time, and Congress in the Dodd-Frank Act wanted to limit the Fed's ability to do that.
Well, I was listening to the Republican debates, and it was quite alarming, really, how opposed they are to raising the debt ceiling or to going any further into debt, and this justifies all mm-hmm. the austerity measures and slashing
yes.
services, selling off public assets, etc. But the obvious solution to that, you could avoid going further into debt by letting the Fed issue the money or letting the U.S. Treasury issue the money in the form of like U.S. notes the way Abraham Lincoln did it. But the objection is going to be that it's irresponsible and that, you know, it's inflationary and so forth. So how can we argue that this is legal, it's not inflationary, and it's the thing to do?
Yeah, I actually think the system we have now is really what's irresponsible. When you look at a state or local government that is trying to invest in its infrastructure, you know, basic capital investment, maybe it's a water treatment facility or a sewage treatment plant. As you know, and I know you've written about it and we've spoken about it, that government entity is going to pay at least twice over when you add in all the interest costs that it will have to spend in servicing its bonds, basically, when it borrows money to make a capital investment. Whereas if the Federal Reserve were to advance the money directly at zero interest, obviously that state or local government is only paying for that investment one time over. And if the money is actually issued directly by the federal government, it could be no cost at all to taxpayers. And in fact, it would probably reduce government deficits because it would be putting taxpaying resources back to work. As these idle resources, whether it's people or businesses, start working again, they're going to be paying taxes. It's going to actually reduce taxes. So fiscally, it makes much more sense to finance capital investments either through the Federal Reserve directly or through the Treasury issuing credits in United States notes, and whether it would be inflationary, only to the extent that it puts people back to work. But isn't that what the point of an economic recovery is supposed to be? And we really are hoping, officially it sounds like, the government has been hoping for a bit of wage inflation. Wages have been stagnant or falling for decades now, to the point where people have woken up and realized we have a real income inequality problem. So a little inflation in certain places is what's needed. Not inflation across the board, but certainly inflating incomes for American workers is what's needed.
And full employment is one of the mandates of the Federal Reserve. It seems to me, I've heard it argued that you can't have both. You can't have full employment and maintain the stability of the currency. But it seems to me that full employment is part of the equation. Like Keynes said, you've got to get the money out there first into the consumers' pockets, and then the consumers spend, and then that stimulates employers to hire people who then create the product to satisfy the demand. So you're not going
to... That's right. And to the degree that part of this full employment program is to steer resources for businesses to invest in their plant and equipment, you're actually increasing the supply, the capacity of the economy to produce, which would help maintain price stability. It would help limit inflation.
Yeah, all the way up to the point of full employment. And it could be argued we're going to create jobs in China before we create them here, so it's going to be a long time before we have full employment in the U.S.
Well, that's true. And actually, that reminds me of a somewhat related public policy issue, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I know you've written about as well. And this proposed multilateral trade and investment agreement, along with a couple of others, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership Agreement, would limit the government's ability to buy America, to basically invest in infrastructure here in the United States by paying American companies and American workers to repair the infrastructure and to build new infrastructure. Under these trade agreements, they'd be required to open up the bidding to Chinese firms. And I know that happened even with the rebuilding of the Oakland Bay Bridge in the Bay Area.
One thing I don't understand, I shouldn't admit this because I've written so many articles on it, but I really still don't understand how quantitative easing works. The money goes into the reserve accounts of banks, right? How does it get out of the reserve accounts? It seems to be stimulating the stock market, but are the banks allowed to use the QE money to buy stocks, or what's the mechanism there?
Well, my understanding, and this is the second way the Fed has been intervening massively in the economy, it's Section 14 of the Federal Reserve Act, which gives the Federal Reserve its open market powers to engage in open market transactions. So when the Federal Reserve purchases treasury bonds or mortgage-backed securities, which it's done an awful lot of in the past few years, it is essentially crediting the accounts of the primary bond dealers, the big Wall Street interests that the Fed does business with. So as those firms have more money in their accounts, the question is, how will it trickle to the rest of the economy? And I know you and I have spoken about this before, and it's rather opaque, these transactions. So it does seem to have the effect of pumping up not just stock markets, but real estate markets in core areas like Manhattan. And it does a lot less for the real economy, for Main Street interests, you can say. It hasn't really trickled down to the Main Street economy. Instead, it results in the private banking sector having a surplus, excess reserves. I think it's approaching $3 trillion of excess reserves that they're sitting on now. And those excess reserves should be theoretically able to support increased lending to the private sector.
Right, but they can't actually use those $3 trillion directly to buy stuff, right? It has to stay in their reserve accounts. I mean, their reserves, but arguably, they can buy securities with the reserves. Is that correct? Can they buy mortgage securities with the reserves?
So then that's my understanding.
Buys mortgage-backed securities, and the money goes. Well, I've read different authorities that say that QE is an asset swap. It doesn't get out of the reserve accounts, and so it can't be spent directly by the banks. I just don't understand that mechanism.
Well, if it's not spent directly by the banks, then how actually is it inflating asset markets?
That that money is serving as collateral in the repo market. So they're taking out big loans in their proprietary trading arms, using that as collateral in some sense, off the books, kind of buried and mysterious.
Well, and that's what I mean by it being really opaque. So if it's collateral in the repo market, it would not end up being lent out, you know, in traditional commercial bank loans.
Right, and it's not actually directly spent. It's just is rolled over, but those loans are then used to buy all those things that we now know that the big banks are, like Goldman Sachs, which is not even a depository bank but has the privileges of a depository bank. It gets to borrow at the Fed window. And buying like gold and silver and commodities and ports and all sorts of big things.
Yeah.
And where are they getting the money? They're leveraging it. I mean, they're borrowing it at almost zero interest from the Federal Reserve, I guess, or from the other banks. And the repo market, I know they can use as collateral these securities, and that was one objection to the Fed buying up all the securities, that now the securities weren't around to be used as collateral in the repo market, that the collateral in the repo market is the equivalent of FDIC insurance in the regular banking, you know, the non-shadow banking system. The commercial banking system has FDIC insurance, which is obviously government backing. So in order for the shadow banking system to have the same sort of reliability, they have the repo market where you actually trade the asset overnight and then you give it back in the morning.
Jennifer Taub has written much about this repo market and it, as being one of the real weak links in the shadow banking system, one that would really, it could implode during a financial meltdown and lead to rather large government bailouts in the future.
It seems to me that since the Federal Reserve had to come up with $16 trillion to back the banks, basically bail out all these big banks, then you could argue that they're all insolvent and they should therefore all be nationalized. All the big banks, all the too big to fail banks actually have failed. So if we did nationalize them, then it would be quite easy to argue that the government itself was the ultimate lender of last year, you know, that it could just issue the credit that it needed for whatever it needed to be done.
It is interesting to compare the Fed's very generous policy of lending trillions of dollars against what many would argue were rather shaky assets as collateral, with the much more recent experience we've seen of the European Central Bank having a much more tight-fisted approach to lending to Greek banks, essentially holding them over a barrel, politically squeezing Greece to impose yet another austerity program, and parts of that austerity program certainly benefit some of these big banks like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, such as through the privatizations of public sector assets.
Well, and they're saying the reason they wouldn't make that liquidity available, which is the equivalent of the liquidity that the Fed made available, the $16 trillion, is that the banks are bankrupt and they didn't think, you know, weren't credit worthy. But our banks were equally bankrupt. So in Europe.
And isn't that the nature of commercial banking in a way?
Yeah.
Banks have been making loans before taking deposits, so to speak, or we could say creating deposits in the process of making loans. And if they're going to continue to be able to meet the reserve requirements, they've got to have a central bank that's lending freely to them.
Yeah. So if we acknowledge that the whole thing requires the backup of government, they should be government banks. I mean, it should be a public utility. It should be run for our benefit, and the profits should go back to the public, don't you think?
I'm in agreement with you. I am. I think this shouldn't be rocket science to have a financial system that serves the interests of the real economy, of real industry, real manufacturing, real people. Instead, we've got it really an upside-down type of a system where the financial system is not serving real needs. It's become rather parasitic, you could say, in rent-seeking, essentially just using its favored position in the marketplace to extract monopoly rents.
Then the question is, how do we get the power to change the system? They're not going to give it up. Big money owns the place. I mean, I think that's what's kind of refreshing about Donald Trump, is that he's not beholden to the big banks, so, and he doesn't like the big banks. So.
Well, I saw that he was asked in an interview last week who he would name to head the Federal Reserve, and he mentioned the Fed's former chairman from the 1980s, Paul Volcker. I suppose compared to Alan Greenspan, who came after him, Paul Volcker does look like a much more responsible figure. But Volcker is still, you know, pretty much of a Main Streeter in many of his, a Wall Streeter in many of his perspectives of the role of a central bank.
Right, and he raised interest rates to 20%, which just killed those third world countries that had variable interest rate loans on probably things they didn't need loans on in the first place that the IMF talked them into.
Absolutely. That monetary experiment in 1979 and 1980 under Volcker was a disaster for a lot of countries and a lot of people around the world. When you have an ideology that the only real cause of inflation is the money supply, and that means that the only tool you'll have to combat inflation is to restrict the money supply and send interest rates up to very high levels, it's a very limited way to look at the economy, and it really simplifies the whole process of inflation in a way that is not very realistic.
Which brings me to the question of the Fed is now threatening or saying they may raise interest rates, which, you know, it's their fault, you could say, that they're so low right now, and so all the pensioners don't have a safe place to put their money where they can make a decent interest rate. So it is a problem, and probably the reason they need to raise rates is that nobody else is buying the federal debt anymore, and so the Fed's buying it all up. But of course, my argument would be they should buy all of it. I think the Fed should buy the whole debt, just hold it, you know, basically turn it into money, because it never gets paid back anyway. I mean, it's just a ruse where the debt keeps growing, and then it freaks out the Republicans who then want to impose debt ceilings.
But it would make a lot more sense to help pensioners, you could say, by having a better Social Security system, where instead of cutting Social Security, we're actually increasing the benefits from Social Security. You could say socializing the retirement, you know, for retirees, rather than raising interest rates, which is a very short-term kind of a way to try to help retirees plan for their future. It's going to end up slowing down the economy, keeping wages rather stagnant, and, you know, that's not going to help people who are trying to plan for their retirements either.
If they raise rates, what will that do to all those derivatives on interest rate swaps? That's the big form of, I think, 80% of derivatives are interest rate swaps.
Yeah, I think interest rate swaps are probably the largest section of derivatives, followed by currency swaps. The credit default swaps that did so much damage in 2008 are actually a smaller portion of the whole derivatives market.
Yeah, so what happens if they raise rates?
Well, nobody knows. I mean, to what degree are the interest rate increases already baked into the market? Have people already been planning for it? Since interest rate swaps are such a huge part of the derivatives market, that means essentially there's been betting on the direction of interest rates. And it'll help some folks who have insured themselves properly against an interest rate increase, but it's a zero-sum game. Somebody else is going to be losing money on the losses from interest rate increases.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would guess the losses are going to be incurred by J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs. They're the big, aren't they the big bettors?
Well, I don't know. Again, for all the talk of Dodd-Frank bringing great reforms, I don't think it's shined that great a light on the derivatives market that we really know who is exposed and who's covered themselves. You know, J.P. Morgan and Goldman are big active players in the market, as they were for credit default swaps, but they saw the market turning in time and used the derivatives market, the credit default swap market, to protect themselves at the expense of who? Bear Stearns, AIG, other groups, you know, institutions that were still writing these insurance policies, basically. So it is possible that J.P. Morgan and Goldman will have good information, you could say, about exactly how much rates will rise and exactly when it'll rise, and they'll protect themselves at somebody else's expense.
Okay, well, and that's not exactly encouraging, but I guess it beats the alternative, which is a huge collapse.
Yeah. Well, but there could still be some big collapses. I'm just suggesting that it's, in my mind, it's more likely to be some other financial institutions rather than ones that are so politically connected, like J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, that they essentially run the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. I think you could say other big financial interests that are don't have quite that level of access are the ones that could be burned the most. And you know, to the point where you might still be looking at some financial bailouts and subsidies that are going to have to happen to prevent the whole system from unwinding when the Fed starts raising rates.
And my last question, since you were advising Bernie Sanders, or are still, I guess, I just wondered what are the chances that he might introduce monetary reform in his campaign, arguably quantitative easing for the people?
Well, the short answer is really that your guess is probably as good as mine. I was active in his Federal Reserve Reform Advisory Committee in 2011 and 2012, and it was mostly a group of economists. As a result of the committee's advice and discussions with Senator Sanders, he did come out with one reform bill to reform the governance structure of the Fed. But that bill did not get reported out of committee. I don't think there was even a hearing on the bill. Unfortunately, you know, the Republicans who control these committees had no interest in real Federal Reserve reform at the time. I know they're talking about reforming the Fed in some other ways now. In more recent months, I've been working with some of Senator Sanders' staff, or speaking with them, I could say, about possible reform measures. I'm really not on the inside. I'm not sure what kind of measures he's looking to introduce during the heat of a campaign versus what he might introduce should he be elected president. I get the feeling that we will hear more from Senator Sanders as far as proposals to reform the Fed and to reform Wall Street and financial transactions taxes. He's already come out with some proposals on some of that, but I think there'll probably be more. Whether he's willing to take the bigger step and talk about reforming the way currency is issued and to have the Treasury issue United States notes, or to have the Federal Reserve do quantitative easing programs for Main Street, I'm really not sure. I haven't gotten a good feel for where he personally stands on those issues. My own feeling, however, is that I don't see any other candidate in the field who would be more receptive to these kinds of changes than Senator Sanders. I don't see any other Democrat or Republican who would be as receptive. You know, I think if there is going to be some political movement afoot to start altering the financial system in these kinds of fundamental ways, it's probably going to require some political success by Senator Sanders during the campaign and see if that creates an opening. Mm-hmm. And then on the Republican side, at least up until now, you know, the Donald Trump surge, and both of these reflect, I think, the same mood in the electorate, that people are tired of establishment politics and they want real alternatives. Of course, the Sanders alternative is quite different from the Trump alternative, but again, I think they both tap into this real type of feeling in the electorate of frustration with the political system and the political parties.
Mm-hmm. And they're both independent of big money for different reasons, but they both
for different reasons
could make
exactly
their own decision.
Yeah, I know. You know, people say, well, maybe Senator Sanders will push Hillary Clinton to more progressive direction, and we hear her even beginning to talk a little bit more progressively. But it's easy to make statements and to talk. You know, when you start looking at her record and the record of Bill Clinton, in many ways, especially on these financial, banking, and trade issues, they were very far from progressive, and Hillary Clinton's been taking an awful lot of money from large corporate interests. So it's easy to talk the talk, but walking the walk's a lot different. And, you know, Bernie Sanders has decades of walking the walk, of not taking money from these big interests, and of pushing back against the corporate tide in trade and banking issues.
Well, it's been really great speaking to you. You're such a fund of knowledge on the legal part of, as you said, you were the only advisor that was a lawyer compared to all the ones who are economists, and it seems like economic theory is a bit far from reality. I mean, everybody complains that it's...
Been a lot of work done by some who have, they've pointed to the fact that so many in the economics establishment have ties to these central banks, whether it's in the form of research grants or other types of, you could say, inducements, and many of them sign non-disclosure agreements, so we don't even know the extent to which the economics establishment has been corrupted and compromised by private banking interests. And it's frustrating because there are a lot of good economists who have proposed a lot of good things, a lot of important changes, but it seems like if it doesn't get an airing from the elite institutions, nothing really changes. And, you know, for that matter, the work that you've done, I think it's been groundbreaking and important in so many ways. And I think, unfortunately, there needs to be a political shift in this country before these kinds of progressive ideas start getting more footing.
Yeah, but it might be the time, because if you look what's going on in Europe, for example, the Italians and the Portuguese and
the Greeks. And in Spain, Podemos is rising as well. So there is this movement. And actually, you don't even have to look at Europe. Look at north of our border. The next month is going to be a very crucial month. We see the conservative Canadian government called for an election. I think the election will be in early October, if I remember correctly. The mainstream liberal opposition party has faded dramatically. And on the left is the New Democratic Party, which is surging. And if the New Democratic Party is elected, I think that'll be the end of Canada's participation in the Trans-Pacific Partnership and maybe some other broad changes in Canadian policy.
Well, it's been wonderful speaking with you.
Well, thank you. My pleasure, as always.
Been speaking with Dr. Tim Canova, Professor of Law and Public Finance at Nova Southeastern University in Florida and an advisor to Bernie Sanders on reforming the Fed.
Thank you, Ellen. Take care.
Thank you.
Well, Ellen, you know, your new article is called "The Trumping the Federal Debt," since Donald Trump is in the news everywhere. And the full title is called "Trumping the Federal Debt Without Playing the Default Card." And you open up with a quote from a post on Sovereign Man where Simon Black argued that Donald Trump might be the right man for the presidency. And his reasoning goes like this. Quote, "There's one thing that really sets him, Donald Trump, apart, and that, in my opinion, makes him the most qualified person for the job. Donald Trump is an expert at declaring bankruptcy. When the going gets tough, Trump stiffs his creditors. He's done it four times. Candidly," Black continues, "this is precisely what the land of the free needs right now, someone who can stop beating around the bush and just get on with it already." So, what's he saying there about bankruptcy and our money, Ellen?
Well, he's saying that we're just going further and further into debt, and we're paying more and more interest on it, which is, I think interest is now something like $450 billion a year, which is about a third of our income tax, a third of the income taxes that we pay. So it's only going to get worse, and we might as well just default and start over again, do the reset.
But a lot of people say, well, we owe that debt to the Chinese. Who do we really owe it to?
We owe it to many different segments. I think about half of it is owed to the U.S. government, including Social Security. $3 trillion of it now is owed to the Federal Reserve due to quantitative easing, and then some to the Chinese, et cetera. So that's the thing. We can't default on the debt. We'll absolutely annoy the creditors, and it's not going to give us a strong economy. I mean, Trump would not do it. So anyway, what Simon Black is recommending is that we default on Social Security and Medicare. Of course, that's what all these conservatives want to do anyway. But that is going to annoy we, the little people, who want our Social Security and Medicare, and it would also annoy Donald Trump. He actually wants to preserve Social Security and wants some sort of health care for all. So he is looking for a more optimistic solution. So what is the solution? That was what I was writing about. We can do what Ron Paul suggested and what Dean Baker suggested. I mean, a number of big hitters have suggested this, which is that just buy up the debt with, or at least we've got that $3 trillion that is already owned by the Federal Reserve, just write that off. I mean, the Fed owns it. They're rebating the interest to the U.S. government, which is great. I mean, that's, it seems to me that you could have the entire debt bought by the Federal Reserve, and it would not change anything except it just looks bad. But it would not. What it would change is we would no longer be paying interest on the debt. And once it's owned by the U.S. government in one form or another, it can just be written off because it's sham debt. It's bogus debt. Now people mm-hmm. would say, well, that'll be inflationary because you're going to put $18 trillion out there, whereas right now all you have is $18 trillion in bonds. But the inflation already happened. It happened when the government issued the bonds. It's just like most of our money supply, we now know, comes from banks when they create loans. And so they put the money out there as a loan, and the borrower goes out and spends it, whereas the depositor whose money was in the bank was not spending it. That's why he had it in the bank in the first place. So mm-hmm. now you've turned it from somebody's savings into the money that somebody's out there spending, competing for goods and services in the economy. Well, that's the same with the federal debt. You have all these savers that want to buy the bonds because they had that money off the market anyway. They weren't going to spend it. And now the federal government takes the money and goes out and spends it in the economy. So that is when the inflation happened, not when the Federal Reserve buys up the bonds with quantitative easing, with money that it creates on its books. Mm-hmm. All it's doing is turning the bonds, which were money in the first place, they're another form of money. They're called near money. You mm-hmm. could spend your bonds just like you can spend your dollars. You have to go through a few more steps, but you can go to, if you've got them on Treasury Direct, assuming they're you've gone past whatever the holding period was, you can just mm-hmm. click on it and you get the money into your account and you can spend it just like anything else. It's just that people don't spend it. They wanted to save that money. Well, if you turn it into cash, they're still going to want to save it. I have most of my money's in cash, and it doesn't make me inclined to run out and spend it. In fact, the reason I have it in cash is that it seems to me that's the safest way to have it nowadays.
I see. Uh-huh.
A lot of people are, like Nomi Prince just recommended that you should put more money in cash. Then there's a question of where you want to put your cash, but that's a whole different issue. I mean, you don't want to put it with one of the too big to fail banks because liable to get lost in a bail-in.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. What if people want to get into cash, but they want to put it in a bank? Does it make a difference if it's a too big to fail bank or a credit union or a local community bank?
It does. And even if you put it in a small bank, the small mm-hmm. bank is maybe use these overnight sweeps. You know, they put it in overnight into a big bank. And if the big bank goes bankrupt, it's going to do it overnight or over a weekend. So you could still lose your money. So what I've heard is one safe place you can park it is in an independent broker like Scottrade, which is not connected to a big bank. But even then, you have to make sure they don't do overnight sweeps. And if you put it in a credit union, you have to check with them and make sure they don't do overnight sweeps. And uh-huh. the safest would actually be to get some large denomination bills and stick them in your safe somewhere.
But then, I see.
If everybody did that, that would be called a run on the banks, and we'd be in.
That's right. And this is not financial advice we're offering here. This is just banter.
No, exactly. We are not financial advisors. I'm just saying that if you had your money in bonds, which are paying almost no interest anyway, and you get a notice from the Federal Reserve or from the government saying that your bonds have just been converted into cash, you're probably going to just leave that money in cash sitting there in your account. Or maybe you'll put it in some other form of investment, but you're not going to rush out and buy consumer goods and services with it. So I'm hoping to inspire either Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders to actually think about changing the monetary system, because we are at the point where we have to do something radical. And the radical thing I would recommend, I used to get pelted with tomatoes for bringing this up, but I think people are now ready for it. You've got more and more experts agreeing that our money is just created by banks anyway. Why are we letting the banks do it and we're paying them interest for it when we the people, through our representative government, could be and should be doing it ourselves interest-free, which would save us 50% on the cost of infrastructure and save us all kinds of kinds of money.
This whole conversation that you brought forward in public banking has really confronted two major myths, at least. And one is that the federal debt doesn't matter, that we can live with it, and secondly, that we can make our own money, in so many words, and that if, for example, a city or a town or a county or a state can create its own money from its assets by capitalizing, by monetizing some of its assets, that is as simple as the case is, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. It is, which brings up another thing in the news, which is Puerto Rico. Interestingly enough, Puerto Rico's bank is a publicly owned bank. And so, you know, I've gotten emails, well, what happened here? What happened to your public banking theory? But here's the problem. Even a public bank needs some lender of last resort. It needs access to liquidity. And Puerto Rico does not, the Puerto Rican Development Bank does not have that because Puerto Rico is not a state. So they're actually in the same position as Greece. Even the Bank of North Dakota has access to the Federal Reserve window and to the Federal Home Loan Bank, which they use both those services all the time. I mean, they're providing liquidity for their local banks, which then go out and make loans into the community. So you just need that backup to balance your books all the time. You know, sometimes you go over, and for that you need to tap into the great source of liquidity in the sky, which is your central bank. So Greece was cut off from the ECB. If the ECB had given them privileges with the central bank, basically the ability to backstop their loans when they went over, then the Greek banks could have been saved, Greece could have been saved, but the ECB cut them off. Similarly, the Federal Reserve does not allow Puerto Rico to have access to that. But before that, for decades, the Puerto Rican Development Bank actually floated the entire economy. I mean, they funded everything. And they did this for many years. They had this remarkable development where they had all kinds of infrastructure was built, and it was all through this publicly owned development bank, which acted like the Brazilian publicly owned development bank. I mean, it just went out there and built things, and they did it by recycling their own assets, as you say. So they recycled all the money from the different government agencies. But now the problem is, first of all, in 2006, the federal government withdrew these corporate privileges, tax privileges, where corporations before wanted to be in Puerto Rico because of these tax privileges. Now they don't have them. So that hurt the economy some. And then in 2008, you had the general collapse that hurt everybody. And our banks, federal banks, got the benefit of the bailout, where they got to get interest-free loans to the tune of $16 trillion or more from the Federal Reserve, but no such thing in Puerto Rico. So they've lost their liquidity. So they're actually having a liquidity crisis, not a solvency crisis.
Right, just like Greece. And, of course, a representative in both cases of privately held central banks. The European problem was the ECB, the IMF, and the EU all being unelected private entities in a position to influence these policies and decisions. Yeah. All right. Well, and what's with China?
Yeah, that's the other thing. So we have what you see all over the net about these currency wars, and oh my God, everything's about to fall apart, and the dollar is going to collapse. Because China devalued their currency, and this is considered currency wars where everybody's competitively devaluing. But I don't think that's what really happened there. I think they were attempting, well, I read this and it made sense to me, that they're attempting to be part of the basket of currencies that will be used for the SDR.
That's the special drawing rights.
Exactly, of the IMF. And to do that, they have to be a currency that's commonly used, which it hasn't been up to date. And so for that, they wanted to release the peg a little bit. They didn't dare release it all the way, because what happens when you let your currency suddenly freely float is all the speculators come in and then they trash your currency. So they just dropped it a little bit. But what was interesting is that it used to be that everybody was all over China because they were supposedly maintaining their currency at a low peg, lower than it would be, and that if they released the peg, it was thought that the yuan would go higher. And what happened when they released the peg is that it actually went lower. So the peg was actually keeping it artificially up. So now we're all over them for competitively devaluing. But really what they're trying to do is just get into the SDR basket. And why not? I mean, it seems to me, why do we really want to be the global reserve currency? It may help the big banks, but it does not help us, the little people. I mean, we just wind up with this huge trade deficit that hurts us competitively. So
yeah.
Anyway, I think it's not to worry. I think it's all good. Let the Chinese and the Russians trade with each other. Why not? Why do we have to have them trading with our currency? I mean, it's all fungible these days anyway. You can get any
right.
Turn.
Well, it's all, as you say, it's all banked. It's a matter of who gets to operate the accounting sheets.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Well, I'll take China off my worry list, and I'll get my money out of the bank and put it in some place I'm not going to tell. Thanks a lot, Ellen.
All right. Thank you.
So we've been talking about the central role of central banks in reclaiming control of our money by and for the people. Matt Stannard gives us a brief visionary look through the window of possibility for the Federal Reserve.
I want you to dream big with me. Imagine a proactive public option, credit and financial services institution at our nation's highest level. Imagine an entity that was controlled by Congress, subject to complete transparency, policy review, scrutiny, reform, and regulation because it was a public entity. Imagine that such an entity had a charter-based mandate to lend to state and local government entities, to erase toxic debt, to fund our nation's crumbling infrastructure, provide quick disaster relief financing, rebuild communities, do all the things the Bank of North Dakota does, but at the federal level. Every once in a while, I come across a group calling for nationalizing the Federal Reserve, a private institution. Well, frankly, if you look at it a certain way, that's not such a bad idea. Once again, let's dream big. Let's imagine what a centralized provider of credit, a huge public banking option, could really do. Low or no interest lending, in fact, is perfectly feasible if the bank doing the lending A, eliminates the middleman, and B, has the full faith and credit of the United States. That's what a federal public bank could do, lend to state and local governments at no interest. And, as Ellen Brown suggested almost 5 years ago, the Federal Reserve could also forgive the entirety of student debt. How do we know the Fed could do this? Because they did something like that already. In its first quantitative easing program, the Fed erased $1.3 trillion in toxic debts from Wall Street banks. They don't even need to be a public bank to do that. Of course, the will to initiate this quantitative easing for the people isn't there. Wall Street bankers have more clout with their fellow bankers at the Fed than ordinary citizens do. But what if the Federal Reserve were not a private entity? What if it were a public bank, subject to control by Congress? I told you I'd be dreaming big today. Dream with me. Then let's talk about how to make it happen. What would it take to make such a change? On the surface, an act of Congress. This is made clear on the Fed's website, that it is subject to congressional review, and that the Fed's responsibilities can be altered by statute. Arguably, Congress could alter these responsibilities either by nationalizing the Federal Reserve itself, or by simply creating a federal agency with such powers and additional responsibilities as designated. That's what it would take on the surface. But realistically, it's going to take much more than that, because we live in a world where good ideas are not enough by themselves. We live in a world where the economic overwhelms the political, and where the political itself overwhelms the gentle realm of good ideas. Nowhere have I seen this phenomenon more clearly than in the public banking movement. In Vermont, in California, in Washington, and elsewhere, we've seen small groups of people make real headway, get policymakers and community leaders solidly behind the idea of public banks. Then, Wall Street helicopters in its lobbyists, they get in our elected officials' faces and often in their wallets, and all the good arguments, all the evidence, all the history, the living example of the Bank of North Dakota, all go away in a puff of disingenuous anti-government smoke. So if we want to reform the Federal Reserve, and particularly if we want to turn it into a public bank, it's going to require the same thing enacting public banks anywhere else is going to require: a mass movement. Elected officials are risk-averse. They're bombarded by Wall Street lobbyists. We need to bombard them with huge numbers of people. So the first step is for you to join the Public Banking Institute by going to publicbankinginstitute.org. And then the real organizing work begins at state, local, and federal levels. These are sites of struggle to reclaim the commons, build a sustainable economy, and make banks, including the nation's most powerful bank, work for us. If we only had a bank. After all, it's our money. I'm Matt Stannard. Thank you.
California's a failure because we haven't got a bank.
Well, what would you do with a bank if you had one?
Do? If California had a bank?
Who could rightly use what's ours to cultivate the flowers and clean our septic tank? We could trade unemployment for service and enjoyment if we only had a bank. When we're stuck and need some credit and Wall Street says forget it, we won't be in the tank. We could pass on lesser offers, borrow cash from our own coffers if we only had a bank. Oh, why? Tell me why. We're sinking lower than we've sunk before, and all the jobs, they've gone offshore. We can stimulate production, construction, and instruction by standing for this plank. Just 11 million voters will be like North Dakota, we'll finally have a bank. If we get up off our assets and get the folks to pass it, we'll finally have a bank. A bank.
That was a reprise performance of Steve Behrman and the Wake Up Laughing Cast, wondering, with Matt Stannard, what we could do if we only had a bank. So, having your own public bank for serving your local public interest is a powerful start to revitalizing local economies. But what about all the other local investing that could be done by moving personal dollars into new types of local investment? What are the reasons and the mechanisms for doing that? Are regular folks even able to participate at that level? Well, there's a new handbook out called Vermont Dollars, Vermont Cents, written by Michael Schumann and the Public Banking Institute's Gwen Hallsmith, that has just emerged and focuses on that very thing. How do we get to that next level of local investing? A topic of Michael Schumann's earlier work.
Michael came out with the book Local Dollars, Local Cents, because that book describes all of the ways in which our investment dollars aren't being invested in anything that could be described as local. You know, he actually talked about it in Vermont one time and chided all of us, local food, local energy, you know, we're pretty good on those fronts. But he says, but how many of you know exactly where all of your 401ks are going? And, you know, you've probably got between $10,000 and $300,000 there that is going completely out of state, not supporting the kinds of business ventures you like. And, you know, what's going on with that, Vermont? You're the localization capital of the world, right? You should be doing more. And he's right. We should be doing more. And one of the other things I became aware of, largely due to Michael's great work, is the fact that each state's laws are different. So the type of crowdfunding and the new rules that are coming out from the SEC at some point in the near future that will allow more flexibility on crowdfunding, Vermont had been using for a long time. You know, that's how Ben and Jerry's got started, in fact, was with something quite like a crowdfunding platform back then. And so I thought it would make sense to do a state-by-state kind of initiative where we talked about all the different things that are already available. Forget the SEC. Forget waiting for them. You know, if you're in Vermont, you don't have to, because the laws are already in place to allow for some type of small investors to make changes to their investment portfolio and really work to shift the burden of where their money is going from Wall Street to Main Street, which is the whole goal. And Michael liked the idea, and I started interns working on it, and we started sort of slowly fundraising for it, and we'd finally gotten to a point where we had the funding for it. And so we went out, fanned out across the state, basically looking for businesses that had used innovative financing techniques, looking for examples of how to relocalize investment money and state money, and came up with a whole compendium of possibilities, largely following the outline of Michael's book called Local Dollars, Local Cents. So there's things that individuals can do if they want to make sure their money is going to help support their local economy. There's things that businesses can do if they're looking to raise money from people in their local area. There's things that finance professionals can do to help set up new things for people to invest in that keep the money locally. And then there's the state and regulatory aspects, and that's where we talk about public banking. And there's also sort of multi-stakeholder models. And so all of these comprise basically a chapter of the book with a variety of different examples of the things that individuals, businesses, finance professionals, governments, and stakeholders can do to shift their investments and ways their monies are at work more locally in Vermont. And now that we've done it in Vermont, we're hoping that other states will be interested. I know I've heard from Colorado, I've heard from Arizona. It's going to be much easier the next time around because we've gotten the structure sorted out. We've gotten some really good examples of how it works. And it's really just a matter of finding the examples in your community and changing the legal section. And you've got another book suited for your state that will help people there grow their local economy.
So how do people get it, Gwen?
Well, right now it can be viewed and downloaded for free from this service called ScribD. You know, I'd encourage people who are working on local economics to get a copy and read it. And I'd be happy also to help people from there on how to go about doing it for their local area.
Well, it seems to me that it's a really important initial handbook, or kind of a Bible for how to invest locally and what the issues and the primary sources are that you need to be considered. You know, personal finances and co-ops and whether local banks or credit unions can get involved and the, you know, pension fund aspect, all sorts of ways in which you're opening up local economies with very specific instructions and examples.
We've been talking with Gwen Hallsmith about the new local investment handbook adaptable for your locale called Vermont Dollars, Vermont Cents. And as Gwen just said, you can download it for free at www.scribd, that's S-C-R-I-B like Bob, D like David, .com. And then simply enter the title name Vermont Dollars, Vermont Cents. Our thanks to Gwen and Michael Schumann for this important new work. That does it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. If you'd like to stay current with Ellen's writing and commentary, visit ellenbrown.com. And if you'd like to know more about public banking and related developments around the country, please visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Visit them on Facebook and follow on Twitter at Public Banks Now. Our thanks to our guest today, and especially to our committed sponsors at Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to economic justice and fairness and the creation of new American public banks. Payment Management offers complimentary analysis of your current credit card needs and expenses at paymentmgmt.com. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. Thanks for listening, and see you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.